So we're pleased to have Ambassador Douglas Lute with us today for this, which is the 477th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, to discuss the current status and future of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO as it's commonly referred to by its acronym. Doug Lute was a career Army officer and retired from active duty in 2010 as a Lieutenant General after 35 years of service. He served for 6 years in the White House during two presidential administrations, first under President George W. Bush as a Deputy National Security Advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan from 2007 to 2009. And he was then the most senior White House official retained by President Obama, serving first as Coordinator for South Asia at the National Security Council and then as a U.S. Ambassador to NATO from 2013 to 2017. So he has some experience at NATO. Ambassador, thank you for joining us today to speak about what's going on in NATO. I thought it'd be interesting to start our discussion today asking you to tell us a little about the history of NATO. It's celebrated its 75th anniversary just this last year, in 2024. It's not the NATO that we started with 12 countries. We're now up to 32, and there's a whole lot of other changes as well. How do we get to where we are now?
You know, George, as I think about those 75 years of NATO history, it's not every one of those years doesn't look like every other year, right? And I break it down into three stages or phases. You might call these NATO 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. Okay, so let me walk through this, and maybe it helps to kind of lay the context for our conversation. So 1949, the Washington Treaty is signed, the treaty that originates NATO, 12 members, right? Named the Washington Treaty because it was signed in Washington, of course. And this is in the immediate aftermath of World War II. You know, Europe is still basically demolished, and only the U.S. was left standing. And the Soviet threat was looming, especially in Eastern Europe. Several countries faced a very dark period economically, and so forth. Europe was prostrate. I mean, it was broken. And so we signed the Washington Treaty. For 40 years, NATO 1.0, basically, the short story was the Cold War and the bipolar standoff between the West, NATO, its original 12 members, and the Soviet bloc. And, of course, the Soviet Union organized the Warsaw Pact, its sort of miniature version of an alliance with seven other countries as well. So the first 40 years featured this bipolar standoff. You know, there were 300,000 American troops in Germany, not in Europe, but in Germany alone at the height of the Cold War. I suspect there are a lot of Cold War veterans in the audience here today. And this featured not only a standoff at the conventional level, but at the intermediate nuclear level and at the strategic nuclear level and so forth. This was a period of arms control, which you know well, George. And it really was a zero-sum bipolar competition in Europe, but was actually global, right? And whatever was good for the United States and the West had to be bad for the Soviet Union. It was a zero-sum game. That period 1.0, came to a screeching halt in 89-91. So it lasted about 40 years. And with the fall of the Berlin Wall in November of 89, a year later, reunification of Germany, unimaginable for me as a Cold Warrior that, you know, East and West Germany would become one. A year after that, now in 91, the breakup of the Soviet Union, the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, and so forth. So it was a real pivotal event, a real historic event that entered into NATO 2.0. And I mark NATO 2.0, this second phase, as about 25 years long, right? Roughly from 89 to 2014. And during NATO 2.0, there were some very significant changes in the alliance. First of all, the mission had gone away because the Soviet Union had gone away. So NATO took on much more importance as a political alliance during that period because its military threat had dissolved. You saw NATO go from the original 12 to 16 members in 1989, and in the course of the next several years, added another dozen members, right? Where did those members come from? They came from the now free Warsaw Pact countries and Soviet republics. Remember, there are 15 Soviet Socialist republics that when the Soviet Union broke up, became independent states. Three of them, the three Baltic states, are now NATO allies. So this was a huge period of expansion in the NATO alliance. Aside from adding members, NATO during that second period, 2.0, added about 40 strategic partners. Now, these are not members. They're not guided by the Washington Treaty. We don't have an obligation to defend them. But these are 40 countries ranging from Mauritania to Japan, geographically, with whom NATO set up partnership arrangements. And these arrangements were two-way streets. The partners would gain access to NATO standards, essentially the gold standard of military operations. They'd gain access to the NATO schoolhouse, the military schoolhouse. So you've got Moroccan soldiers at the NATO college in Rome and so forth, right? And NATO would benefit as well. NATO would get a better understanding of regions beyond its borders than it would have if it only talked to itself, right? So you have Middle Eastern partners, Pacific partners, South Asian partners, and Eastern European partners who inform NATO on a consultative basis. And NATO actually, I think, improved its understanding of its environment by way of these partnerships. NATO took its show on the road. Remember in 95, just a few years after the beginning of NATO 2.0, NATO troops went into Bosnia. A couple years later, Kosovo. After 9/11, into Afghanistan. And by the way, they stayed with us in Afghanistan for 20 years, right? All of that happened because NATO had time and space in NATO 2.0 that it didn't have earlier because of the standoff with the Soviet Union. Now, why do I mark 2014 as the end of 2.0 and what I think now is the third phase, NATO 3.0? That's because with the Russian seizing of the Crimean Peninsula, the destabilizing of the southeastern part of Ukraine, the Donbas region, I think you have another significant break in the continuity of the history of NATO. Here's the first time since the end of World War II that the UN Charter is violated in such an explicit way, right? A violation of territorial integrity and national sovereignty of a neighboring state. And with that invasion, I think, reminded NATO of its roots. So in some way, NATO 3.0 and the period going forward from 2014 looks a lot like the Cold War or the emergence of a bipolar standoff. Now, we're going to get into more about Ukraine and so forth, but I do think that it's important that NATO has gone back to basics now in this most recent period and brought back to the front of its priorities, the top of its priorities, where it started, which is the self-defense, the mutual defense of our European allies.
I think, you know, as you talk, there are a couple of things that come to mind. One is you talk about the expansion and, you know, the late 1990s, early 2000s, and the moving east in NATO. Do you think it was wise for us to have that major expansion at that time? Did this bring the bear back? Did it bring Russia back into a more of an adversarial relationship, or didn't have any effect on that?
Well, there's two prominent arguments with regard to this question. One is the one you're suggesting, which is as NATO enlarged eastward and moved its borders closer to the Russian borders, that inevitably we provoked Russian insecurities, physical insecurities, right? And this goes back to Russian history and this deep sense of Russian insecurity about its western borders, right? That's kind of one view, one argument. There's another narrative, though, and it's the one I favor, which is that for the first time in decades, where countries in Eastern Europe, and in some cases, as I've mentioned, the three Baltic states, which had been part of the USSR, right? When they were given a choice, out from beneath the thumb of Soviet oppression, to make a sovereign decision about Do they want to align east or do they want to align west? Given that choice, all of them chose to walk west, right? And who can deny that? I mean, who can deny a nation's sovereign right to choose its own path? So when you go from the end of the Cold War, 16 allies, to today, double, 32, every one of those 16 most recent additions to the alliance started with a national, inside their capital, a national decision on how they wanted to go. So if you believe in national sovereignty, then you got to kind of believe in their right to choose. So that's where I stand. I think it's the right to choose. By the way, you know, there's some pretty good empirical data, too, that Putin's narrative that he's been provoked by NATO expansion stuff, it just doesn't hold water. I mean, the most recent case is Finland, of course, which now has the longest NATO land border with Russia, right? Joined 2 years ago, okay? And if Putin were afraid or concerned, threatened by Finland's addition, one would argue he'd be reinforcing that border, right? NATO's about to invade, according to Vladimir. No, he did just the reverse. He took troops away from the Finnish border, the Western Military District, and sent them to Ukraine, okay? So it doesn't appear he's too concerned about an invasion from NATO.
Well, there's another aspect to the expansion that I wanted to explore with you a little bit, and that is, originally it was 12 very like-minded nations who formed NATO. Right. As we have expanded, we get some nations that don't seem to have the same views we have. Like Hungary comes to mind, Turkey with being on, you know, the border between us and Russia come to mind. Well, you know, what effect internally has it had on NATO to have this broad expansion?
You're right. NATO was pretty homogeneous in 1949, right? And in fact, those of you who carry the Washington Treaty around in your breast pocket, you, at this point, you want to pull that out, okay? And look, the second sentence of the NATO Treaty, which, by the way, that's it. That's the whole treaty, okay? I mean, it's really pretty remarkable, given that it's endured these 75 years. But the second sentence says, everybody who signs up for this believes in democracy, individual liberty, and rule of law. Not bad, right? 1949. And yet, as you mentioned, now that we've become more diverse at 32, you have to ask, how are we doing against those three founding values? And I'd argue that it's a pretty mixed bag, right? I mean, Mr. Orban's Hungary, Mr. Erdogan's Turkey, Mr. Kaczynski's Poland, he's not in power right now, but he's in the shadows in Poland. Those don't look like democracy, individual liberty, and rule of law. And quite candidly, as Americans, we ought to take a hard look at those three values ourselves, right? How do we stand against those three founding values? And what's important about this, right, is that before you get to Article 5, the clause of an attack on one is an attack on all, you got to sign up for those three values. And so when you get to Article 5, a decision to activate NATO as an alliance, as an institution, if an attack on one occurs, depends on a consensus agreement. So today, the vote to go for NATO to go to war, not individual allies, but NATO as an institution to go to war, the vote is 32-0, or you don't go to war. NATO does not activate. Now, that doesn't mean individual allies don't go, right? But it's got to be 32-0. A decision to add a new member, witness most recently Finland and Sweden, has to be 32-0. So when you get these democratic outliers, like Hungary, for example, and Turkey, who, by the way, withheld their vote for Swedish accession until certain concessions were met, right? They demonstrated that it still takes consensus. So the diversity of alliance, on the one hand, you say, well, diversity is not a bad thing. On the other hand, when the institution makes its big decisions by consensus, it becomes much more complicated.
Over this period of time, phase 1, 2, and 3, how has the U.S. role changed in NATO? Is the U.S. have essentially the same role we've had, or the same leadership role?
I would argue yes, up until January 20th at noon on 2017, okay, when Donald Trump became the first president to take office, and then the long, decades-long history of NATO, to actually question the value of the alliance. I mean, that's a fundamental shift for the alliance. And, you know, as Americans, it's interesting, right? We have a very different perspective on national security than most of our European allies do. And the fundamental difference is we don't really count on anybody else. We are sort of, you know, America can do it. I mean, look at our defense budget, for example, right? And we have a global presence, we have global capabilities. And yeah, allies are great, but we're not really counting on them. We're counting on our capabilities. That's not the case among our European allies. They are counting in an existential way. They're counting on our being there. I mean, think of the three Baltic states. They can't defend themselves. They're counting on Article 5 of the Washington Treaty. So it's a very different take. And so when we have a president, as candidate Trump in 2016 made clear, and then as he said even in his inauguration speech in 2017, when he cast doubt on that U.S. commitment, it has huge reverberations across the NATO alliance. And so, yeah, it's different. And now, of course, we're going to see Trump 2.0, I guess, right? Trump 2. And those same anxieties are popping up again.
Then I thought I'd move on to talk about some of the issues that are facing NATO right now. I mean, there's Ukraine and the questions of defense spending, the U.S. Role in NATO, which you just were talking about, new technologies, a whole bunch of them. And rather than to try to go through all of those, I want to put the onus on you. What do you think is the most important issue facing NATO right now?
That's easy, Ukraine. I mean, if Ukraine falls to Russian aggression, or it capitulates because of the support for Ukraine falling off, right? If Putin is seen as successful in his land grab, in his violation of Ukrainian sovereignty, and his violation of Ukrainian territorial integrity, then all bets are off. And if he does, if Putin wins, it'll be in no small part because of what we fail to do, what we, America, fails to do, right? And if we, America, fail to give Ukraine what it needs to not only survive, but I would argue to win, and we should go into what does that actually mean, right? If we fail to do that, then I think our commitment to the rest of the alliance, who are actually, we're treaty-bound with regard to the alliance in a way we're not obliged to Ukraine, is important. You know, it's very interesting to examine the gap between how important we say Ukraine is, right? I mean, you have historic pivot point, existential crisis, you know, Article 2 of the UN Charter, national sovereignty, territorial integrity, and all that, right? And what we've actually done to secure those values, to secure those goals. I argue that there's a huge gap between our rhetoric and what we're actually doing. And here I break with this current administration for another week. I break with them because I argue that, as an old military guy, we've given Ukraine enough military support not to lose. We have not given Ukraine enough to win. And that the difference between not losing and winning has been paid in Ukrainian blood. And I think it's unconscionable. It's a violation of basic military science. It's military malpractice by my West Point classmate, Lloyd Austin, who I consider a friend, okay? But nonetheless, we have not done enough. You know, the Biden administration is going to leave office with presidential drawdown authority granted by Congress to support Ukraine on the table. In other words, they haven't deployed it all. Something like $3 billion worth of support that they're gonna pass to the next administration. Well, who knows what's gonna happen with the next administration? So it's just been too little, too late, and the Ukrainians have paid a high price.
Well, let me return a little then to what you've mentioned, the Russian takeover of 2014. Should our response have been stronger then? Were we too mild?
Yeah, I've got some personal responsibility for this because I argued at the time. So remember, so 2014, in the first months of 2014, Putin seizes Crimea. This is the story of the little green men. Remember this? There's this special forces, Russian special forces, uniformed personnel. They take their name tags and their unit insignia off, and they essentially liberate the Crimea Peninsula, which had for about 200 years been part of Ukraine. And then they go into the Donbas in mainland Ukraine, right, and support the Ukrainian separatist movements. These are mostly motorcycle gang-like organizations, right? They're not sophisticated militaries. But the Russians pumped sophisticated equipment to them. And by those two moves, Crimea and the Donbas, essentially challenged NATO in a way that it hadn't been challenged since the fall of the wall. And that's why I marked 2014 as the beginning of the next phase, right? I was in the chair at NATO at the time, and there was an argument within the alliance about how much should we support Ukraine now that there's evidence, physical evidence, that Putin's serious about destabilizing Ukraine. And the bottom line is, largely based on the Obama administration lead, we did too little. So this too little, too late story doesn't start with Joe Biden. It started before then. And I remember the debate at the time was, should we provide Ukraine in 2014 lethal weaponry? And most prominently, shoulder-fired anti-tank systems, right? This so-called Javelin. And the administration decided not to do so, but rather to provide logistics support, non-lethal assistance, and military training, which the Ukrainians really needed. But none of that was going to really deter Vladimir Putin. And I think Putin looked at the gap between 2014 and his wholesale, full-scale invasion in 2022, sort of took account of how much response he could expect from the West and decided to move in. So I think we bear some of the responsibility for that.
And how did we view, in 1994, I believe it was, the Bucharest Agreement, where we and...
Budapest.
No, where we and Russia and the UK agreed to uphold the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and in return, Ukraine moved all of its nuclear weapons back to Russia. I mean, did that play into in 2014 when the Russians were, you know, violating that agreement? I mean,
well, you're right. So in Budapest in 1994, the U.S., the U.K., Russia guaranteed if Ukraine gave up its third largest in the world nuclear arsenal, right, and returned those nuclear weapons to secure sites in Russia, in Mother Russia, that those guarantor states would essentially secure the territorial integrity of Ukraine once it had denuclearized, right? Well, first of all, if you're in Ukraine today, people remember the Budapest Agreement, right? Because they argue that 2014, 2022 might not have happened if Ukraine was still a nuclear state. So one of the big, I think, reverberations, one of the potential aftershocks of the 2022 invasion may well be that other states, Ukraine, yes, but other states around the world as well, argue that, you know, it's a real pain to become a nuclear weapon state, but ultimately, it's the only guarantee. Something on writing and a bilateral security agreement is just paper. And you hear this all the time. I've been to Kyiv 5 times in the last couple years, and you hear them in a very sober way argue that they took that promise in 1994 and it really wasn't worth anything. And so fast forward to today, when we consider, when we contemplate Ukraine going into a negotiation arrangement with probably supported by us, I hope supported by us, but talking across the table to Vladimir Putin, what Ukraine is, I doubt Ukraine will settle for some sort of a promise of future security. They've lived that life. And they've now lost hundreds of thousands of citizens, proving that The Budapest Agreement wasn't worth the paper that it was written on.
Let's continue talking about nuclear weapons for a minute, one of my favorite topics. Russia, of course, is a major nuclear, second largest nuclear, maybe has a larger number, I know they have a larger number of nuclear weapons than the U.S. Would we have acted differently toward Ukraine if they'd have been attacked by a country that wasn't nuclear armed?
So, you know, the administration, the Biden administration in particular, argues that the reason it has taken this incremental approach to military assistance, right? So remember, initially we were talking about javelins, then we were talking about Stinger anti-aircraft missiles, then we were talking about tanks, and then we were talking about rocket artillery, and then we were talking about Patriots, and then eventually we're talking about F-16s, right? That this very incremental approach was in part explained by a concern about the fact that one of the protagonists here was a nuclear power. And of course, Putin has repeatedly reminded everybody that he's got nuclear weapons, right? It means sort of every other week or so, he issues some sort of veiled threat about the power of nuclear weapons. So this fear of escalation from tanks to nuclear weapons, right, was part of the justification, I think, of the Biden administration's hesitance to give Ukraine early on what it needed to survive and even win when it had an opportunity. The challenge now, though, is that while that might have been reasonable in the first weeks, because you had the first conventional war on the European continent since World War II, right, with a nuclear power involved, that's something that's going to get your attention in the White House Situation Room, right? But now we have 3 years of evidence, of empirical experience, that those fears of escalation were probably over-amplified by us. We deterred ourselves. Let me give you a couple examples. The early weeks in 2022, when the Russian military was humiliated on the axes headed into Kyiv, they couldn't even make it to Kyiv. Remember? And this is, you know, columns of tanks being destroyed on the road and so forth, right? Later in 2022, the wholesale evacuation withdrawal around Kharkiv by the Russian forces. Later, the more organized but still retreat from Kherson province to the east bank of the Dnipro River. The fact that the Black Sea Fleet has largely been destroyed and the remnants have been evacuated off the Crimea Peninsula. The Black Sea Fleet is not in Crimea anymore, where it's been, where it was for 150 years. Why? Because of Ukrainian military capability. And did that evacuation of this crown jewel of Russian security, the Black Sea Fleet, did that trigger nuclear escalation? No. And now you have this sort of indigenous drone capability of the Ukrainians hitting oil refineries, military headquarters, strategic air bases inside Russia. Did that trigger nuclear escalation? No. Now you have Ukrainian ground forces occupying a slice of Russia, right? In Kursk, the Kursk Oblast. So sovereign Russian territory, there are Ukrainian troops occupying that Russian territory. By the way, riding in American armored vehicles. You think, wow, that's going to trigger, it didn't trigger nuclear escalation. So what the hell are we worried about? And why haven't we given Ukraine what they need? Now, I'm not suggesting giving them nuclear weapons, okay? But I am suggesting that this very incremental approach that has seen so many Ukrainians pay the highest price is no longer justifiable. And I make the case in particular, to be very tactical here, that we should have given Ukraine a sufficient quantity of long-range precision strike systems, ATACMS, which is actually an acronym, but it's an acronym that's reasonably accurate. It's what it does, right? It ATACMS, okay? Think a 200-mile range ballistic missile, ground-to-ground ballistic missile, right? Which if the Ukrainians had sufficient quantity and the U.S. okay to fire into Russia, that this could be a very different picture today. But again, we've been very slow, deliberate, too little, too late, and incremental in our support. And the result is the Russians have had 3 years to dig in the Donbas. So when you have National Security Advisor nominee Mike Waltz say on, I don't know, publicly over the last week or so, that he can't imagine evicting the Russian occupiers from Ukrainian terrain. Well, you know, we ought to take some responsibility for that. We've given them 3 years, okay, to build those defenses and to build the logistics nodes and so forth. And the last point I make on this, I get emotional on this one. There's a bridge that Putin built between mainland Russia and the Crimea Peninsula, the Kerch Strait Bridge, right? It still stands. It is the single lifeline to Russian occupation of Crimea, okay? And we have not given the Ukrainians what they need with the authorities they need to take down that lifeline. The Russian army in Ukraine is vulnerable. And I say this on two counts. First of all, it's a low-grade army. This is not the 82nd Airborne Division. You see all sorts of evidence of this. You see desertions, you see war crimes, you see indiscipline, you see reports of mass infantry mass attacks, frontal attacks, with the officers behind the soldiers forcing them into the front. These are signs, these are indicators of a low-quality army. If you isolate that low-quality army from its logistics base in the middle of a Ukrainian winter, you've got a recipe for progress here, okay? But we have denied the Ukrainians the ability to cut those supply lines, like the Kerch Strait Bridge. One last point. The Russian army has traditionally relied on railroad-based logistics. This is because they field large armies, so they need the volume of railroads over long distances, right? And so the geography has caused the Russian logistics system, military logistics system, to depend on railroads. Well, railroads are vulnerable, okay? They don't move. Okay, the trains move up, I got you. But, you know, the bridges, the tunnels, the engine yards, the diesel fuel capacity for the engines, the switching yards are all fixed sites, which if attacked, you can imagine isolating that low-grade Russian army in the height of the Ukrainian winter, and Putin may see this war in a very different light. But we have denied the Ukrainians the ability to do that. And I think it's unconscionable.
Well, I could go on forever on this because I think it's really, really interesting. But there's some other challenges faced by Russia as well, by NATO as well.
Yeah.
In a week, we're going to have a new president, and he's made all sorts of statements about withdrawal from NATO, or what should happen to nations that don't spend enough money, the agreed amount of money, etc. So, what's going to happen to NATO when the new president gets in? And if he does withdraw or reduce the U.S. role significantly, can the Europeans defend themselves against possible threats?
Wow. Okay, so there's a lot there. Let me take that in bites. Okay, first of all, the reality about NATO defense spending, okay? There's two forms of NATO defense spending. The first is common funding. So this is where all 32 allies contribute to a common fund to keep the lights on at NATO headquarters. Okay, this is not buying rockets, tanks, aircraft. It's essentially an operating budget. It's $2 billion a year. We paid against a prescribed proportionate basis. I think the U.S. pays 17% of that, which is actually less than our GDP. On a GDP basis, we're getting a deal with NATO. The other form of NATO spending, though, which President Trump refuses to be educated about this, right, is not NATO. Countries don't pay their defense budget into some, you know, country club pool membership fund, which allows them to be part of the alliance. The funding that he's talking about is national defense spending. So the national defense spending of Germany, for example, appropriated by the Bundestag, right, doesn't go to NATO, it goes to Germany, right? And in 2014, when Obama was in the chair as U.S. president, and in the wake of Crimea and the Donbas, and frankly ISIS as well, which happened on NATO's border, the Allied leaders took a historic decision, which was, okay, we've been talking about 2% of GDP as about the right amount of national commitment to defense spending. Let's put it in writing. So the first time under Obama in 2014, they signed this pledge that everybody would be at or above 2% in a decade, within a decade. It was largely sparked by Putin, right? Where are we a decade later? Now, 23 of the 32 countries are at or above 2%. When we started, it was 3. In 2014, it was 3. Today, it's 23. So that's significant progress, right? If you take the U.S. out of the calculations, across the other 31 members of the alliance, the average is 2%. So that's not good enough. You still have Canada, for example, an ally not far from here, right? That's at like 1.3% with no plan to get to 2%, even though the 10-year pledge to do so has now expired. That's just unsatisfactory. So in some ways, Trump's got an argument here about, you know, those who are underperforming on NATO defense spending. But overall, there's been success. Now, you also hear the president-elect say, take credit for the fact that there are now 23, you know, and his team will remind us on, you know, the public airways that if it weren't for Trump yelling at these guys, okay, there'd be even a worse picture in national defense spending. And a lot of times in sessions like this, I take the question, well, wait a second, who's more responsible for increased defense spending in NATO? Is it Obama, who had the pledge signed, right? And now you've seen the progress. Or is it Trump, who humiliated allies like Angela Merkel in public, yelling at them? Well, both of those are wrong. It's Vladimir Putin, okay? They got the wrong president here, okay? Vladimir Putin is the president most responsible for that progress in European defense spending. Now, is that enough? No, it's probably not. And why is that? It's in part because in NATO 2.0, after the fall of the Soviet Union, the breakup of the Soviet Union, European governments, our European allies, took national decisions that shifted money wholesale out of the defense budget and into other programs, infrastructure, social programs, and so forth, right? And, you know, that's not unreasonable. The Soviet Union had dissolved, right? And the problem, though, is that now that the Soviet Union light is back under Vladimir Putin, the defense industrial base in Europe simply does not exist. And I would guess it would take 20 years. I mean, we've got some defense industrial experts in the room today, but my guess is they're probably 15 or 20 years away from what it would take to replace the U.S. industrial base, which, by the way, has its own problems. I mean, our industrial base has problems as well. But you can't start from scratch and just turn the faucet on defense spending and produce Patriots, Leopard armored vehicles, and F-35s, and so forth. So for now, it is absolutely essential, and our European allies will continue to depend on us as a base. As one case in point, you know, weeks after the 2022 invasion of Ukraine, Chancellor Scholz in Germany got through the Bundestag, the German parliament, right? Was second, or the largest economy in Europe, right? A 100 billion euro supplemental funding. What have the Germans done with that 100 billion euro funding? The F-35 and the Chinook helicopter, both U.S. systems. Why? There was nothing on the shelf in the European defense industrial base they wanted to buy. So the atrophy of the defense industrial base is really the core answer to your question, which is, yes, they could do it, but they're not going to do it fast.
I'm going to ask that people pick up questions that you might have, and I think lots of things to ask about. While they're collecting the questions, talk a little bit about the technology challenges that NATO faces. I mean, the war in Ukraine has shown the real value of drones, and cyber is now a huge, huge thing. Is NATO up to the task now on these areas? And what have we learned from the war in Ukraine? Yeah. Do we use it?
Well, emerging technologies would be an issue if there were no war in Ukraine. But of course there is, right? NATO in particular has paid attention to this shift in the importance of cybersecurity and has done some very reasonable things in terms of cybersecurity, most of which Well, in fact, when the NSA director comes, Mike Rogers, in a couple months, you should ask him about this, because I think NATO is much better placed in terms of securing its systems against cyber attack than maybe it was a decade ago. But you're right. The Ukraine war is essentially a laboratory for the evolution of warfare. Basically, on a recent visit to Ukraine, I went out to a Ukrainian drone unit. So first of all, they have whole units which do nothing but fabricate, adapt, and launch drones. That's it. They never see the Russians except by video, okay? And they're launching these drones 10, 20 miles away, and the drones literally loiter around particular areas until they detect a Russian target, and then the scout drone talks to the attack drone, which attacks the Russians. They innovate that drone system every 3 to 6 weeks. Now, how do they innovate? They innovate by way of the communications techniques. How do they talk into the drones? Because if they don't innovate, the Russians jam the comms networks and make the and disable the drones. So they have to constantly adapt on a basically just several weeks to stay in front of the Russian counterproposals. So that laboratory is dictating the future of ground warfare. And we have to begin to pay attention to this. Now, I would argue that one of the benefits of having a laboratory of modern warfare on our doorstep is that, wow, we should go to school on this, right? Why don't we have select numbers of American special forces embedded with these drone units and chatting back to their home bases at Fort Bragg and elsewhere around the special operations community about what they're seeing the Ukrainians do. Look, as a veteran of the U.S. Army, it'll take us a decade to get the lessons learned straight, and they're innovating on a three-week basis. Okay, we will never catch up with the potential of learning from Ukraine unless we're willing to take a little risk. But look, I went there in a t-shirt and a baseball hat, okay? Why isn't there a special operations sergeant embedded with this drone unit feeding back into the U.S. schoolhouse and the U.S. training base about what the Ukrainians are doing? The Ukrainians today are the most capable land force in Europe. Most combat capable, most adaptive, most innovative, most resourceful. And this is what it comes when you're fighting for your life, okay? And so one thing we ought to really be doing, and we're underperforming, is taking the lessons that the Ukrainians are learning in such a hard school and putting them into the NATO acquisition base, so buying equipment, its training base and its leadership base, so that we can learn from that. But we are simply not doing it. We're deterred, okay, which is crazy. There's a laboratory in our backyard. Why don't we go out and participate?
One thing I wanted to follow up on, something you said earlier, and someone asked the question, so it made me think about it. You said we were going to talk a little bit about what it would mean for Ukraine to win.
Yeah.
And, you know, militarily, politically, what would you consider to be a Ukrainian win in this, given the current situation?
Well, I'm still stuck a little bit on the fact and the assessment that we missed our best opportunity, which was the summer of 23, the fighting season of 2023, to give Ukraine what they needed to actually take back their territory. I think there was a window when Ukraine could have regained much of the occupied territory. That window has now, I think, passed, right? And it's passed in part because of our very deliberate support process, but it's also passed because the Russians have now dug in. And the Russians are pretty good defenders. I mean, they know how to defend. So that occupied territory could be part of the win equation. But it will have to now, because of the reality of the last 3 years, it'll have to be placed out into the future. So I would imagine winning would entail, first of all, in terms of territory, a stabilizing of the front lines, right? So the Russians are not constantly pressing up against the front lines. A recognition internationally that the occupied territory will never be recognized as Russian, even Crimea. It will not be recognized. And by the way, there's precedence for this, right? I mean, we never recognized the Russian occupation of the Baltic states for 40 years, right? So there's some precedent for acknowledging that that territory still belongs to Ukraine. And then winning means equipping Ukraine so that a ceasefire is more than a pause, right? And this is the gap between pause and peace. In order for peace to settle into Ukraine, it's got to have a sufficient deterrent capacity so that Putin or his successor doesn't simply wait 6, 8, or 10 years and do this all over again, right? That's a big bill to pay to give Ukraine that kind of capability. It certainly means they're going to have longer range capability that puts valuable assets inside Russia at risk. So I'm not suggesting giving Ukraine nuclear weapons, but there are conventional weapons that would make a big difference here, and we have not given Ukraine that. And then finally, I think Ukraine needs to be confident that we've got its back. And frankly, my last two trips, so summer and fall of this year to Ukraine, there's a degree of skepticism about our support that is creeping into private conversations with Ukrainian partners. And they've paid, as I've said, a very heavy price for this Biden administration approach, too little, too late. And they're suspicious about what lies ahead. Now, the gold standard there would be Ukraine becomes part of NATO, even if part of its territory is occupied. Remember, West Germany was part of NATO, East Germany was not, right? So there's some models that could apply here with regard to NATO membership as part of a winning equation. The challenge there is, as we've already discussed, the vote on that, adding Ukraine to NATO, 32-0, okay? That's what it's gotta be, it's in the treaty. So can you imagine Viktor Orban from Hungary, who gets all his natural gas from Russia, voting to admit Ukraine? Can you imagine Donald Trump? It turns out we can't even imagine Joe Biden, okay, supporting NATO membership. So it's doable, but it's long, hard, and bloody. And what we have to figure out is it really worth it? Can we tolerate, can the international system tolerate such a blatant violation of the rules, like the invasion in 2022? And I'm not sure we can, because there are dozens of other territorial disputes around the world today. Think about the Taiwan Straits and the 100 miles separating mainland China from Taiwan. There are a lot of territorial disputes that could draw lessons from what happens in Ukraine. And so I'm a big advocate of giving Ukraine what they need and figuring out, winning may mean that some NATO allies, probably not NATO as an institution, but some NATO allies actually base units, troops, on Ukrainian soil. And you could see them running training bases and so forth, right? But the concern I have is that there'll be a rush to a ceasefire, right? And the rush to the ceasefire will not really be peace. It'll be a pause, okay? And against a larger industrialized war state economy like Russia's, a pause only benefits Putin. It doesn't benefit Zelensky and the Ukrainian people. And we're just setting ourselves to kick this can down the road until Putin or his successor decides that it's time for another try.
You mentioned something, and I've got a bunch of questions related to it, so I wanted to pursue it a little bit more. What lessons will China take from NATO's response to the Russian invasion? And what role would NATO have if China were to follow Russia's lead and invade Taiwan.
Right. So obviously NATO has no obligation to get involved in a China-Taiwan conflict, right? I hope that President Xi of China is watching this closely. And I'm hopeful that he'll think quietly in his office one day with no aides around and just wonder about two questions. The first question is, you know, my friend Vlad Putin, okay, invaded Ukraine based on what his generals were telling him about the army he had at hand, right? Which was an army that was the product of a decade of Russian investment in the military. Okay, they had reorganized battalion tactical groups, they had gone through training, they'd gone through acquisition programs and all that sort of thing. And I hope she is wondering, you know, I'm concluding about a decade of investment in the Chinese military, in the PLA, I wonder if I'm going to be taken like Putin was, right? Can I believe my investment in the PLA the way Putin obviously believed his and was proven wrong? The other thing I hope he's thinking about in this private, you know, pensive moment in his office, I hope he's looking at his tabletop and looking at a map and noticing the difference between Russia and Ukraine and China and Taiwan, which is 100 miles of open sea between mainland China and Taiwan. And I hope he's saying, wow, you know, Putin's had a real time attacking a neighboring state, no 100-mile boundary, right? And he's paying a very he's lost his army in Ukraine, and now the homeland itself is paying a price. How much more complicated would be an amphibious airborne operation across that 100 miles of open sea between mainland China and Taiwan? And I hope he's concluding that military operation, the one he might be thinking about, is an order of magnitude or two more complex than what Putin faced in Ukraine. So I'm hoping he's taking those two lessons that serve as a deterrent for him. And that's another reason, by the way, right? Implied in that question is another reason why we can't just give up and give Ukraine this win. I mean, who cares about the Donbas, right? Most people can't find Crimea on the map. Other people are watching.
Let's go back to Russian intentions again for a minute. Of course, the seizure of Crimea was not the first time Russia has shown an aggression since against a former Soviet state. The first one was Georgia.
2008.
Moldova is, you know, widely speculated that might be next. If Putin gets what he wants in Ukraine, what would be next on Putin's agenda? Do you think he's finished there in Ukraine, or is he going to move forward into the Baltics, for example?
So often in Washington, there's talk about red lines, right? These are lines in international affairs that one should never cross, right? This red line, that red line. I believe there is one red line that Putin really understands, and that's the red line of NATO territory. I do not believe that the Baltic states, for example, are sort of next just because they're convenient. I think he understands the power of NATO. I think deterrence still works, essentially. There are things we should do to improve his understanding of NATO capabilities. So you do this by way of exercises. You know, there are American troops today stationed from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. NATO troops, or U.S. troops, right? Why? Why are they there? They're not there to stop a Russian invasion. They're there to trigger a U.S. response if somebody comes across that red line. So you have, I mean, the last time I was in Lithuania, you know, I went to see an American armor brigade right up against the border, the Lithuanian border with Russia. And they're living large. I mean, they're playing basketball out there, and they're exercising. There's a tank range, so they get to fire their tanks. And, you know, it's great, because otherwise they'd be in, you know, Fort Hood, Texas or someplace, right? So they're Fort Cavazos. Sorry, they changed the name. But The point is, there are ways to reinforce the deterrent pledge of the defense of NATO. And I think the administration, here I give the administration pretty high marks in terms of the sorts of things they've done. Now the question will be, does the Trump administration see that as a worthwhile investment? Because it's not cheap, right? I hope they do.
I mean, several questions here. I know when my wife Karen was going to NATO, she'd come back from meetings wanting to vote Germany out of NATO. And there's several questions here on whether there is a procedure. If Hungary, if Turkey proved to be big impediments, is there a way to vote them off the island?
No. Amazing, right? Again, back to the treaty. There's no eviction clause in this treaty. In fact, the only way a country, the treaty accounts for someone to leave the alliance is if that country chooses to leave, right? And then I think you got to give the landlord something like a year's notice or something, right? Because think about it, 1949, which of those European allies, right, could we ever imagine would want to leave this good deal of NATO? And of course, so it didn't make it in. What's interesting about the U.S. situation, you know, could the U.S. actually decide to leave? The answer is yes. The president could take that executive decision. But a year ago, the National Defense Authorization Act includes a provision where the Congress must get involved in that decision. And largely, that's interpreted as meaning that the two-thirds majority in the Senate required to join NATO would be required to agree to leave NATO. Can you imagine the U.S. Senate agreeing on anything today at two-thirds majority? Okay, so I take some comfort that this is that there's a narrative, there's a rhetoric line, a rhetorical line here from the Trump administration about leaving NATO, but I don't think it's that easy.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate your time.
Really big pleasure.